You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. The following lesson comes from a three-part teaching series called Valiant for Truth. In this particular lesson, Pastor Peter Montoro explains how we can evaluate the ideas we encounter in life and culture.
Father, I come before you tonight. I need your wisdom to be able to talk about these matters. And we all need the presence of your Spirit. Give us wisdom, give us discernment, give us good conversation, give me clarity. And may we be led to live like Christians in the world in which we live as a result of these lessons and conversations. In Christ's name I pray, amen. Do all of you have the handout that was passed out? Good. So the first part of Pilgrim's Progress tells the story of Christian's journey from the city of destruction to the celestial city. So that's Pilgrim's Progress, the first part. The second part of Pilgrim's Progress tells the story of Christian's wife, Christiana, as she also goes on the journey to the celestial city. And as Christiana is on her journey, she is escorted by a certain Mr. Greatheart, who's one of Bunyan's wonderful characters, and they go through eight stages of the journey. And in the final stage of the journey, as they're nearing the celestial city, Greatheart and Christiana and Mercy and their whole company meet up with a man named Valiant for Truth. And Bunyan just has this amazing knack for taking passages of Scripture and turning them into the most remarkable names you could imagine. And so you got this Valiant for Truth, and when they come upon him, he has just been fighting off three adversaries at once: Wildhead, Inconsiderate, and Pragmatic. And they've been coming at Valiant for Truth, and he's been holding them off with his right Jerusalem blade in Bunyan's terminology. And then when they hear Greatheart and company getting close, then Wildhead, Inconsiderate, and Pragmatic run off. And Valiant for Truth and Greatheart have a conversation about being Valiant for Truth. And this name, Valiant for Truth, comes from Jeremiah 9:3, where God is condemning the people of Israel. And he says this: they bend their tongues like their bow for lies, but they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me, saith the Lord. Now, I trust that most of us here, if not all of us here, would desire to be more like Mr. Valiant for Truth than the lying schemers of Jeremiah's day. We want to be people that fight for what is true and right and good. We don't want to be people who give in to lies and deception. We want to stand up for true ideas, and we want to stand against false ideas. And yet, though this zeal is a very good thing, misdirected zeal can end up making a mess, adding to the confusion that makes it so difficult for our society to see the truth. As Paul testified to the Romans, as he exemplified in his own life, it is altogether possible to have a zeal that is not according to knowledge, a zeal that results in more destruction, that obscures the very truths that it seeks to defend. So if we are to use the sword of the Spirit to bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, we cannot just swing our swords just any way that we please. If we're to love the Lord our God with all of our minds as well as our hearts, we're going to have to discipline our minds in the path of wisdom. And so this is going to be a very general overview of how to evaluate or judge ideas. And really, this could be a many-part series, but we're just going to sort of give that 30,000-foot flyover and see if we can have some good conversation and some ideas on this topic. And so we'll be covering three basic areas. We want to get the facts right, we want to get the spirit right, and we want to get the targets right. So facts and spirit and targets, those will be the three big areas we'll be talking about. And the first area under getting the facts right is that we should research before we respond. Research before response. Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verse 12, if thou shalt hear, say, in one of thy cities. So if there's some hearsay that's going about on the street in a city of the land of Israel, which the Lord thy God hath given thee to dwell there, saying, certain men, the children of Belial, are gone out from among you, and have withdrawn the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which ye have not known. Then shalt thou inquire, and make search, and ask diligently, And behold, if it be truth, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought among you, thou shalt surely smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, destroying it utterly, and all that is therein, and the cattle thereof with the edge of the sword. Now, we don't live in the same period of covenantal history as the children of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, so I'm not talking about being valiant for truth by slaughtering cattle or people, right? That's not the point that we learn from this. But what we learn from this is that there's a pattern, there's an appropriate way for us in the new covenant to respond to evil, to respond to bad ideas. But that pattern that we find in Deuteronomy, that you hear of something and then you check it out to see if it's true before you do something about it, that pattern applies in every period of covenantal history. Jesus said, "Judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment." So in this text, there's a scenario that's presented. You hear something awful, and then you determine that it's your responsibility to respond to it. We don't have to determine or research every awful thing in the world everywhere. If we had that responsibility, we would all go crazy. But you hear something, and you think, this is something I need to say something about because of my position in the world or because of the influence I might have. I need to say or do something about this. And then you see if what you heard is actually true. And you see if it's true before you share it with all of your friends. Because that's actually how harm is caused. You hear something, and then it gets shared, and then it gets shared, and you get shared, and you can never get the toothpaste back in the tube. So before you take whatever action you're going to take, you see if it's true. And then you respond. So I'm going to give some examples. I'm going to be giving examples from both the right and the left. Missing these things is no respecter of political party. So I already mentioned this several months ago when it happened, but Jesse Melton was running for the U.S. Congress. I forget where she was running for. And there was a doctored tweet that purported to be from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC as she's known, because her name is hard to say. Now, as you know, I am no fan, well, whatsoever, of AOC as a politician. I do not agree with her policies. We could go on that on another day in another setting. However, this tweet that was shared was purported to be a tweet that AOC had written saying it's vital that governors maintain restrictions on businesses until after the November elections because economic recovery will help Trump be reelected. A few business closures or job losses is a small price to pay to be free from his presidency. So this was a tweet that was purporting to come from AOC. The problem was she did not write that tweet. Now, she's written many, many problematic tweets, but that particular one that went viral on social media was invented. And so when it was pointed out that there was no such tweet, then the person who sent it out, Jesse Melton, doubled down and said, well, we don't know whether or not she sent it and wrote it originally. But the problem is this. If you're a politician of any standing whatsoever, all of your tweets are archived. You can go back and see what was originally posted. And in fact, it was known that she did not send that. And all it would have taken was a quick fact check looking at the history, and it would have been clear that this actually wasn't true. Now, you may think that that is what she actually thought. That's possible. But you can't say that that is what she actually sent because that wasn't true, so it shouldn't have been shared. And all the people who shared and shared and shared and shared and made it go viral should have taken the time to check and see, was this actually true? Well, this isn't something that just happens on the political right, as you know. Recently, there was a story that Rolling Stone and a number of other national outlets put out that ivermectin overdoses were so overwhelming Oklahoma emergency rooms that gunshot victims could no longer get treatment. How many of you saw that story or that headline or the infuriated responses to it? Some of you. So there was a doctor who did an interview with a local station in Oklahoma warning against the dangers of overdosing on ivermectin. So a local reporter arranged the quotes to make it appear that he was saying that ivermectin overdoses were responsible for overwhelming the ERs of Oklahoma hospitals. And then it got picked up by national news outlets like Rolling Stone and the New York Daily News with headlines like this. Gunshot victims left waiting as horse dewormer overdoses overwhelm Oklahoma hospitals, doctor says. That was Rolling Stone's headline. Problem? Not true. Were there some people who overdosed on ivermectin? Yes. Were there anywhere near enough of them to have an impact on the ERs in Oklahoma? No. But here's the thing. It fit Rolling Stone's political agenda to say that, just like it fit Jesse Melton's election campaign to say what she said. And in both cases, rather than checking something that seemed to fit their narrative, they just ran with it, and ran with it, and ran with it, and doubled down on it. And so, as Christians, the lesson we learn from Deuteronomy is that when we hear something that fits our preconceived ideas of the way the world is, we shouldn't assume that it's necessarily true. We should especially be suspicious of the things that are really convenient for us. And so, if in Deuteronomy, if that other city that was committing idolatry just happened to be the city that was putting your businesses out of business, the more motivated you are out of business, then you should be especially careful to double check. Because the more motivation that we have to believe something ill of our enemies, the more careful we should be to make sure that it's true. So that's the first principle. The first principle is that we should research things before we respond to them. We should not assume that everything ill about our enemies is always necessarily true, lest we become guilty of sharing falsehood or slander. Slander is still a sin, even when it's directed against the people we might think deserve it. Any questions about that before we move on? Second point, of geese and ganders. Another passage from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 13. Thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, or different weights, a great and a small. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, different measures, a great and a small. But thou shalt have a perfect and just weight. A perfect and just measure shalt thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So here's the scenario that's being envisioned. Back in the times in which Deuteronomy was written, many things would be done on a weight basis. And so let's say you came with your grain, and you were going to sell your grain to the merchant. So if the merchant was unjust, he would put the balance weight on the scale when he weighed in your grain, and he would weigh in your grain light. So he would say, you didn't bring as much as you actually did. So you came in with 3 bushels of grain, and he would weigh it in at 2.5 bushels of grain. And then when he was weighing whatever was being given in exchange for the grain, well, you'd have another weight, and he would weigh what he was giving you back, weigh that in heavy. So you came perhaps to exchange some grain for some peas, so he'd weigh your grain as less than it really was, and he'd weigh the peas he was giving you in exchange as more than it really was. So you'd have 2 different systems of measurement, one for me and one for you. Everybody get that? That doesn't just happen with grain and peas or whatever it was that they were exchanging in the land of Israel that was in view in Deuteronomy. This happens in our society all the time. Once again, I'm going to give 2 examples, one from the right and one from the left, because this happens in our society at all levels and from all positions. Example number 1, I am old enough, just barely, but I am old enough to remember the furor over Bill Clinton's infidelities. And all the political commentary on how anyone who would not be faithful was unfit for public office. Fast forward 20 years or so, and the same people who were very hasty to condemn Bill Clinton were equally hasty to defend Donald Trump for his infidelities. Now, regardless of the question of whether someone who is unfaithful to their wife ought to be considered for public office, that's a separate question. But the simple truth is, we're not allowed to have a double standard. So you are allowed to change your mind. So it may be they were wrong about Bill Clinton, and they needed to repent about that. Or they were right, and they needed to accept an inconvenient truth in our own day. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have 2 standards. Another case in point, Brett Kavanaugh and Joe Biden. You either believe all accusations or you don't believe all accusations. You can't believe them when they're convenient, and disbelieve them when they're inconvenient. If you believe the standard should be they should be investigated, then they should all be investigated. But you don't get to have two separate standards, one for my people and one for your people. That's injustice. So we should research before we respond, and we should judge according to one standard, not one for us and one for them. But simply attempting to do these things isn't enough. There are snares along the path that can keep us from finding the truth, even when we have a sincere desire to seek it. So let's talk about some snares along the path. The simple fact that the QAnon cult uses "do your own research" as a tagline is enough to tell us that there are snares along the path of research, and not everything that is labeled research actually arrives at the truth. If we're going to learn about what's going on in our world, we need to learn from those who know what they're talking about and have a motivation to tell the truth, because neither expertise nor sincerity alone is sufficient. You need both. One or the other alone is worse than useless. We need to realize that most of the major problems in our society do not have a simple answer. If they had a simple answer, they would have been solved already. The fact that they haven't been solved is why they are major problems. And those who claim to be able to reduce the most complicated problems of society to tweetable sound bites are either fools or knaves or both, no matter what political party they affiliate themselves with. And though we don't have the time to go into this in great detail, this is really another topic. The greatest problem that we face as a society is that we have chosen to live on an inhuman scale out of our sheer pride in human ability. We have built, as a society, not just America, but all over the industrialized world, we've built our own Tower of Babel. And since we were designed for Eden and not Babel, we shouldn't be surprised that there aren't always going to be solutions that enable us to recreate Eden in the furnaces of Babylon. It's a little bit metaphorical, but we can talk about that on another day. More to the point, though, we need to realize that our media environment, so the environment in which we live, in which we receive news, in which we seek truth or don't seek truth, has problems that run much deeper than the political affiliation or bias of this or that news source. So there's an old line, you probably have all heard it, to someone who only has a hammer, everything looks like a nail. How many of you have heard that? There's a lot of truth to that. And the point that is being gotten at is that the environment in which we live and the tools that we use shape the way that we see the world, regardless of what our particular intentions may be. And so the way that most Americans receive their news is actually a much bigger problem than the bias of those from whom they receive it, even though both of those things are true. So the mechanisms by which we receive our news distort the news that we receive, that the mechanisms themselves hinder us from arriving at the truth that we may be very sincere in seeking. As we try to dig into this, it'd be helpful to begin with a discussion of what is known as hyperpalatable foods. How many of you have heard that term before? Hyperpalatable foods? No? All right, well, you're about to learn what it's talking about. So hyperpalatable foods are foods that, as one source explains, are deliberately engineered in such a way that they surpass the reward properties of traditional foods, such as vegetables, fruits, and nuts. Food chemists achieve this by suffusing products with increased levels of fat, sugar, flavors, and food additives. The reason for the rise in obesity isn't simply because people have less self-control, though that's true. It is also because there are people who are smarter than you are who have a vested interest in increasing your consumption of their foods, and they're good at what they do. So if you design a food to be more desirable than any natural food, and also badder for you, not worse for you, than any natural food, then you're going to want that food that has been designed not to be nutritious, but to be desirable. And then you see an advertisement that makes it hyper attractive to your eyes as well as to your taste buds. And so we have an epidemic of obesity in America that is really, really bad for our health. And one of the significant reasons for that is the design of foods to increase our desire for them. And the transformation in our media environment has been much more dramatic than the transformation in our food environment. So to begin with, how many of you, did you all understand the point I was getting at with hyperpalatable foods? How many of you understand what that's talking about now? Right? Anybody have any questions about that? All right, good. So that was just an illustration to a tool to use to think as we think about the problem of the news environment in which we live. To begin with, we need to realize there is no such thing as free news. There's no free lunch and there's no free news. So if you don't pay with your money, you're paying in another way. And if you're paying in another way, the way that you're paying is going to distort the news that you're receiving. If you pay with your attention, for instance, via advertisements, then there's a vested financial interest in getting you to click on the news story or to continue to watch the news story, even if the truth has to be stretched in order to make it appetizing. Why was it that Rolling Stone didn't check up on that story, didn't call the doctor the quotes supposedly came from, didn't call the hospital the doctor supposedly worked at? Why did they run it as an international story without checking on it? Well, the answer is obvious. They had a financial incentive to do so because that was going to get a whole lot of clicks from their readership. And in fact, it did get a whole lot of clicks from their readership. And subsequently, it was a source of embarrassment to them. But the news cycle is short. And so ultimately, they probably think they made the right. I don't know this. I shouldn't attribute. You know, that would be to violate one of the things I'm going to recommend. So I won't say this. But anyways, the point is that when media is supported by advertisements, there's a vested interest in pushing out stories that will get your attention, whether they are true or not. Long ago, Neil Postman, how many of you are familiar with Amusing Ourselves to Death or any of the other works of Neil Postman? It's a great book to read, and his other books are good as well, most of them. Long ago, Neil Postman made the point that commercial-supported TV, this was before the age of the internet, but Postman made the point that commercial-supported TV, no matter what the purported subject, is always entertainment. The way that commercials break everything up and put everything from the most serious to the most trivial of subjects together in one constantly flashing sequence reduces everything to the level of entertainment. And everything has to be made entertaining to be portrayed on advertisement-supported television. So even if they want to tell you the truth, even if they are personally clear-sighted and morally upright people, the bottom line of commercial-supported news demands on keeping your attention. And keeping your attention depends on keeping you scared and angry at someone or something. That's how it works. And as you can, you know, guess, that distorts any ability to arrive at the truth. Though television was already a massive problem, social media has amplified this problem 10 times or 100 times or maybe even more times over. And the dynamics of social media are driven not by the people who run the companies and whatever they may say in public, but by the artificial intelligence algorithms that they have built to run their products for them. And while the human interventions of social media companies skew dramatically to the left, the algorithms don't really care about politics. They care only about your attention. It's all about monetizing your eyeballs. Here's a quote from a recent article in First Things magazine. The point of these algorithms is to maintain users' attention, especially to promote click-throughs. As one researcher explains, and he goes on to quote from this researcher, the solution is simply to present items that the user likes to click on, right? Wrong. The solution is to change the user's preferences so that they become more predictable. A more predictable user can be fed items that they are likely to click on, thereby generating more revenue. People with more extreme political views, and more extreme views in general, tend to be more predictable in which items they will click on. Like any rational entity, the algorithm learns how to modify the state of its environment, in this case, the user's mind, in order to maximize its own reward. In other words, instead of shaping the product to the customer's needs, social media algorithms manipulate their subjects. As the process continues, small encouragements have large effects, altering taste and interest in a slow and cunning brainwashing that reinforces extreme dispositions. End quote. Once again, the algorithm doesn't care what your extreme position is. The algorithm, and the algorithm is what runs all of these social media companies, the algorithms only care that you continue to click and 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 to scroll and to tap and all the rest. And in an environment like this, hyperpalatable stories are always going to rise to the top. In fact, you'll find that the more shared a story is, the more likely it is to be false. Because just as natural foods, so if you raise kids on junk food, if you raise them on, you know, frozen junk food, and they eat frozen junk food every day, they're not going to like to eat spinach, because spinach can't compete with the reward properties of junk food, because junk food is engineered to create desire. And spinach is designed by God to be nutritious. Right? And the same thing is true of social media stories. In the environment of social media, false stories that are engineered to get clicks and attention are going to drive out true stories over and over and over again. Disinformation is engineered to be palatable and clickable, and it's going to drive out good information. And it doesn't matter whether you're conservative or what your politics might be in your media bubble, whatever your political affiliation may be, in that media bubble, disinformation that appeals to your basest desires is going to drive out information that might challenge your basest desires. And so you'll become more extreme and more convinced that everyone who thinks differently than you is crazy. Moving forward, one more thing. Innumeracy is a major problem. Skewed statistics distort reality. As human beings, once again, this goes back to the fact that we are living on an inhuman scale in our society. And living on an inhuman scale, we are constantly confronted with numbers that are bigger than most of our minds can actually process. I'll give two examples of how this shows up. In 2009, once again, there's a liberal and a conservative example. In 2009, when President Obama, this is a quote, I'll skip the quote and just explain it. In 2009, then-President Obama announced that his administration was going to cut a whole $100 million from the federal budget. Well, the problem with that is the federal budget at the time, it's bigger now, was $3.5 trillion. And $100 million is less than one-third of 1% of $3.5 trillion. So cutting $100 million off the federal budget would make no difference whatsoever. It was simply a ploy to make it sound like fiscal conservatism, because most people, when you hear $100 million or $100 billion, your mind doesn't immediately process the difference. So if somebody doesn't point out, that actually doesn't make any difference at all. It just sounds like a big number. And so we think it's a big deal. But without knowing the base rate of what it's being compared to, we have no idea whether a certain number is a big deal or not. And so people will, this is how this misinformation or disinformation or lack of context information spreads so much, is there's big numbers, and they may not even be false, but without the appropriate context, they can feed into whatever narrative you want them to feed into. So going back to the federal budget, and this from the other side, in a primary debates at various points in the past decade or so, many Republican candidates have proposed to cut foreign aid in order to cut down the same federal budget. So the rhetoric goes like this: why are we giving so many billions of dollars to other countries when our own budget is so big? We need to stop that Democrat spending in foreign countries and focus on our needs close at home. So that's the rhetoric. Same problem as with President Obama. The entire foreign aid budget is less than 1% of the federal budget, and has been for the past decade. Cutting all foreign aid would make no difference in the deficit and the budget whatsoever, given the large numbers that are involved. It's just a rhetorical ploy that makes no practical difference when you understand the context of the numbers. So this is something to be alert for. So we've talked about Three dangers. Obviously, there's many more. We've talked about the dangers of advertisement. There's no free news. We've talked about going viral, the dangers of social media. And we made a brief dip into how skewed statistics distort reality. So what, if anything, can we do about this if we're trying to be people who stand for the truth? Well, as I mentioned earlier, anyone who says there's a simple solution to a problem as complex like this is either a fool or a knave or both. So I'm going to try to be not foolish or knavish in telling you that there's a silver bullet that can solve all of these problems, because I don't think there is. However, though we can't fix all of these problems overnight, there are steps we can take that can help nudge us in the right direction. There are things we can do that are more helpful than not. First, we can prioritize anti-polarizing news sources. What do I mean by an anti-polarizing news source? I mean, prioritize those news sources that consistently run stories that are critical of their own side. So stories that, when something is damaging on their team, they're just as clear and just as straightforward about it as when something is damaging about the people they don't like. That's a clear indicator. Doesn't mean that everything they say is necessarily going to be true, but that's something to be watching for. Prioritize anti-polarizing news sources. Prioritize news sources that are pushing against this extreme tribalism that we see in our society. Second, incentivize truth by paying for it. If you want to get truthful news, you're going to have to pay some money for it. There's no other way around it. Because anything that is paid for by advertisements or by sharing, any of these other things, has a built-in incentive to lie to you. Now, it may be you can pay someone to lie to you, too. Just because you pay money does not mean that you're automatically going to get truth. But if you want to live by the truth, you're going to have to be willing to pay someone to give truth to you. There's a third thing, though, that may be just as significant as these, or even more significant than these. Increase your bandwidth with background knowledge. There's two types of bandwidth. One is temporal bandwidth. So we live in a society that has an idolatry of the present. So everyone lives right now in the moment, and people forget what happened even 5, even 10 years ago, and we just live in this hyper-present society. But the problem with living in the present is that we become like tumbleweeds that are blown about wherever the wind goes. So if you want to have some bandwidth, some depth, you need to have an understanding of some of the things that have taken place in past history. Because otherwise, we'll be completely consumed with whatever the narrative of the moment is. And so having some temporal bandwidth can help. I'll give you a few examples. So our society is hyperpolarized right now. All of you already know that. That's what we've been talking about for the past half hour or so. But our society as America has been hyperpolarized before. So if you've studied American history, you know that the election of 1800 saw political rhetoric that was even more extreme than what we're seeing in most places today. If you studied American history, you know that Woodrow Wilson took away more First Amendment rights than anyone is even talking about taking away today. The First Amendment was effectually suspended during World War I, completely. There was no freedom of the press, for instance, during World War I. And so if you know some of this background knowledge, it can help you to be able to evaluate what's taking place in our day. So temporal bandwidth is understanding some things that have taken place in the past. Another thing of temporal bandwidth is realizing that most Christians throughout history have lived under societies that were oppressive, and they still were able to be faithful. And that can encourage us that simply because we face oppression or a lack of freedom in this or that area doesn't mean we can't be faithful to Jesus, because this has been the norm for the church throughout the millennia. And so we shouldn't be shocked or surprised if we get back from this golden bubble back to the norm of the church in most times and in most places. So temporal bandwidth would be understanding what's taken place in the past, so that we have some anchors to keep us from being blown away by the winds of the present. There's also geographical bandwidth. So if all we focus on is what's taking place in our country or in our state or in our city, then we have a very narrow perspective. But being somewhat aware of what's taking place in other parts of the world can give us a different perspective. So having a geographical bandwidth, so having temporal bandwidth is like dropping anchors down. Having geographical bandwidth is like those trucks that have the riggers that go out. So when it goes way, way, way up high, what are those, Nate, what are those called? Do you know? What? Sure, that. But you know the trucks that, the forklift, I mean the bucket trucks that go way, way up. Yeah, that. So I've seen, I don't know if all boom trucks have this, but I've seen, is it outriggers that go out to stabilize the vehicle when it goes way, way up high? Is that right? Yeah, so when we have a sense of what's going on in other parts of the world, it's like putting outriggers out that keep us from tipping over when we get to perilous heights of confusion in the particular place where we are. It gives us a stability. So those are some things that we can do that can be helpful. We can prioritize anti-polarizing news sources. We can incentivize truth by paying for it, and we can increase our bandwidth, increase our temporal and our geographical bandwidth. So that is the first portion of the lesson, getting the facts right. Any questions or comments up to this point?
Maybe not right now, but sometime can we put out like a list of news sources? Like I get a lot of my news from the Epoch Times.
Yeah, so I think that'd be a conversation. I think that'd be a conversation I'd rather have person to person. I'd be hesitant to like send out from the church like here's the official news sources, but I can tell you the ones that I like. I just would be hesitant to do that from the even though I'm not from the pulpit, I still would be a little hesitant to be like, here's the news sources the church recommends, but I'll tell you afterwards the ones that I found beneficial. Anyone else? All right. That's a good question. I knew I was going to get that question, but I just feel hesitant about that. But as a friend, I'd be happy to share that. So we talked about getting the facts right. Let's talk about getting the spirit right. Our spirit should be patient. Wherefore, James says, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. The broader your speech will carry, the more carefully it needs to be considered. Let me say that again. The broader your speech will carry, the more carefully it needs to be considered. This is one of the problems with social media, is that people who have not earned the right to speak to a broad audience gain the ability to speak to a broad audience. And people don't have a sense of how far their words will carry. Because even if you only have 20 friends, one of those friends could have a friend that has a lot of friends, and something you intended as an in-group attack could become a global assault on a poor, hapless soul who happened to get off on your bad side one day. So there's no sense, there's no ability of calculating how far your words are going to reach. So in general, if you post something on social media, assume the whole world will read it and judge accordingly. If that's a high standard, consider not posting on social media. The broader your speech will carry, the more carefully it needs to be considered. So I take great care in my sermons because I'm speaking to the whole church. And when I'm preaching, I'm not only speaking to the whole church and anyone who might listen to the sermons online, but I also claim to be speaking with the authority of God and the authority of His Word. And so when I'm speaking in the office of pastor, this is what the Word of God has to say to you. I'm going to be very, very careful what I say. I also try to be careful in my private conversations, but if I trust the person I'm speaking to, I'm not afraid to sort of sort things out, try ideas out, that I may say, oh, I said that didn't work, scratch that one, right? So if I'm talking to two friends after church, I still need to be careful of the way my words can impact. We're going to be talking about that in the third lesson in the series. We still have to be careful about the speech that we use, but the more people are going to hear our words, the more guarded we need to be. That's the general principle. Righteousness requires reflection. We saw this with Joseph when we had our message on Joseph, Mary's husband. While he thought on these things, Joseph didn't immediately respond to the appearance of Mary's infidelity. Because he was righteous, he took time to reflect on the right thing to do. And in that, Joseph contrasted strongly with Judah and Judah's response to Tamar, whose immediate response was, let her be burnt. After all, Tamar was an inconvenience to him. And so he took it as an opportunity to get her out of the way. We don't have time to go through that whole thing again, but those of you who heard the message may recall some of that. Righteousness requires reflection. We need to have a patient spirit. As Matthew Henry puts it, were there more of deliberation in our censures and judgments, there would be more of mercy and moderation in them. So patient, charitable. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity. We always fight like Christians. We always treat others as we would want to be treated, no matter how evil they are. We always love our enemies. Calling evil evil is one thing, and it's a good thing, and it's something we should do. But delighting in evil for the very shock value of it is something totally different. C.S. Lewis put it like this. The real test is this. Suppose one reads a story of filthy atrocities in the paper. Then suppose that something turns up suggesting that the story might not be quite true or not quite so bad as it was made out. Is one's first feeling, thank God, even they aren't quite so bad as that? Or is it a feeling of disappointment or even a determination to cling to the first story for the sheer pleasure of thinking your enemies as bad as possible? If it is the second, then it is, I'm afraid, the first step in a process which, if followed to the end, will make us devils. This witness is true. And the reason why we all face this temptation, I face this temptation, you face this temptation, is because if those we don't like, if our enemies are pure, so to use a Lord of the Rings analogy, if the enemies are orcs, pure and unrelieved evil, you don't really have to confront the pride and gold lust of your own dwarvish heart. The more evil your enemies are, the lower the standards you can set for the evil in your own heart. And all of us face that temptation. And that is why we need to treat others as we would be treated. Third, humble. We need to be humble rather than arrogant, sober-minded rather than high-minded, serious rather than shrill. Wherefore he saith, James says, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. It's easy to pick problems with other people's solutions. It's harder to come up with anything better. There are always trade-offs in every solution to a complex societal problem. The bigger the problem, the bigger the trade-offs that are going to be necessary. And rather than being intoxicated with showing how foolish our opponents are, we should put the majority of our energy, we should remember that this is only useful to the degree that we have something better to put in its place. This is Christianity 101. But just as purity is a particular challenge for those who live in a red light district, in which absolutely everything that surrounds you is attempting to get you to lust, so these ordinary Christian virtues of humility and charity and patience are going to be a challenge in the news environment in which we live, in which everything that is coming at us is trying to get us to be uncharitable and hasty and high-minded. So we live in a news environment that is as dedicated to getting us to act like not Christians as a red light district is getting people to act like not Christians in the area of sexual purity. And we have to be aware of that, and therefore we have to be constantly vigilant. So get the facts right. Get the spirit right. And now we come to our third point. Get the targets right. If we aren't careful, we can defend our enemies and strike out at our allies. We don't have to wade into every battle or have an opinion on every topic. But if we do, we have an obligation to do our homework. You don't have to carry or draw a gun. But if you do, you better be careful where you aim it. First, don't put all your enemies in one basket. Don't put all your enemies in one basket. I'm going to start with a quote from Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. It is necessary, Hitler says, to suggest to the people that the most varied enemies all belong to the same category, and to lump all adversaries together so that it will appear to the mass of our own partisans that the struggle is being waged against a single enemy. This fortifies their faith in their rights and increases their exasperation against those who would assail them. This is propaganda 101. This is what, if we really want to be valiant for truth, we must not do. This is what dictators do. If you lump all enemies, everyone you're opposed to, into one giant wastebasket, it is much easier to get people to hate them because they apply the hate that they have for one group in that basket to the whole basket. This, like I said, is propaganda 101, and we should not follow that path. All of us have a tendency to make really big sweeping statements that lump a lot of people together. But sometimes there can be a lot of people who are all wrong, but wrong to different degrees and in different ways, ways that require different responses. Simply because a group of people has something in common, and simply because they're all wrong, doesn't mean they all belong in the same basket. This is the golden rule. We want to be treated. We ought to treat others as we want to be treated. So I want us to engage in a thought experiment. Imagine you're someone who is a gay rights activist. You are for homosexuality. Right? This is hard for us to imagine. But you've got two groups. You've got Westside Baptist Church, and we're opposed to homosexuality very strongly. We think it's sinful. We think it's wrong. In fact, we're opposed to all sexuality outside of marriage. But at the same time, we love those who sin against God in that way, just as we seek to love all sinners. And we want what is good for them. Right? Are you with me? That's where we are. Over here, you've got Westboro Baptist, who have signs. God hates fags. Fags should receive the death penalty. Right? Now, both Westside and Westboro have some things in common. We are both opposed to homosexuality in all circumstances and in all situations. Right? But our overall attitude and approach is radically different. So someone who is for homosexuality is going to be opposed to both Westboro and Westside Baptist, but it would be fundamentally untruthful of them to treat us as though we advocated the same policies and procedures and engaged in the same behaviors as Westboro Baptist does. Now, this is the reason I picked this example is because all of us have had interactions with people who assume that if you oppose homosexuality at all, then you must be put all homosexuals to death like Westboro Baptist, that you must be a bigot. And none of us like that accusation because hopefully, by God's grace, it isn't true. Hopefully we're opposed to sin because it's destructive, not because we hate people or are phobic of them or whatever. We think sin is sin and sin is destructive and we're opposed to sin. So, if we don't want to be treated that way, if we don't want to be lumped in with people who share something in common with us but who are fundamentally different from us, then we shouldn't do that to others. And all of you can think of ways in which we've done that or attempted to do that in discussions in our present culture. Moving on, though. So the first one is don't put all your enemies in one basket. Respond appropriately to what people actually get wrong. Second, fight ideas rather than slogans. So what are some examples of slogans? Arminianism and Calvinism are the perfect examples of slogans. Now, at a certain level, all of us use shorthand to refer to different groups that we may be for or against, identified with, or whatever. And this is in part how language works. But before we get our sword out based on our understanding of the shorthand, we'd better check that what we're going after actually mean what we think they mean. So the classic Calvinist attack on Arminianism is that, well, you just believe that you are saved because of your own wisdom and because you are smarter than your neighbors, right? How many of you have heard someone describe Arminianism in that way? The classic attack on Calvinism is you don't believe in preaching the gospel. You just think that you know, God saves who he wants to save, and so it doesn't really matter whether or not you preach the gospel, whether or not you call on people to believe. How many of you heard that description of Calvinism? All right? Now, there are Arminians who believe that they are saved because of their own wisdom or ability. That's true. There are some Calvinists who don't preach the gospel. But most Calvinists preach the gospel, and most Arminians believe and ascribe their salvation to the grace of God in their life. And so if we're going to deal honestly, rather than saying, I hate Calvinism, and here's all the evils of Calvinism, we actually have to consider, who are we talking to, and what do they actually believe? What are the ideas that they actually hold? And respond to those. It's not that there's no difference between those two as theological systems. It's just that when we have a tendency to lump everyone together, pick the worst possible example, and ascribe it to everyone we can possibly ascribe that label to. And so, for instance, I don't really like the term Calvinist, but I would certainly consider myself Reformed, as most of you know. But if you are here in the service this morning, you know that, or really almost any service, any morning, on Sunday morning, you know that I believe in pleading with sinners to come to faith. And you know that I believe that anyone anywhere who calls on Christ for salvation will be saved. Right? I believe that. In fact, I believe that because of my Reformed convictions. And that's, so if you want to, so rather than sticking a label on someone and saying, well, because you have that label, therefore you are to be condemned, we need to actually talk about ideas, because it may be that we have more in common with the people we're attacking than we realize. It may be we actually have a massive divide, but we won't know that as long as we only talk about slogans and labels. We have to get down to brass tacks and talk about actual ideas. And all of you could think of a lot of other labels and slogans that are swirling around in our society, but we need to move on. Third point, respond to what people do with ideas rather than where you think they got them. Respond to what people do with ideas rather than where you think they got them. So grand narratives, intellectual history as a sort of the history of ideas is a very interesting thing to read. And it can be useful in getting the lay of the land. But knowing where an idea comes from doesn't tell you if it is a good or bad idea. Because of common grace and universal sin, awful people can have good ideas and well-intentioned people can have dreadful ideas. So rather than saying, you got that idea from a forbidden source, therefore you must believe all the things that forbidden source believes, therefore you're evil, therefore I'm going to come after you with all the might of my Twitter storm, rather than doing that, we need to ask, what is someone doing with their idea? So I'll give you an example. A preacher could preach that men are to take responsibility in their home. Men are to be the leaders of their home. That's not hypothetical. That's something that I have preached. That's something that Pastor Craig preached before me. And that's something, by God's grace, that will always be preached from this pulpit or podium, wherever the preaching happens to be taking place. Someone could take that idea and say, I'm to take responsibility in my home. Therefore, I'm going to work. I'm going to lead. I'm going to provide for my wife. Someone could hear that same message and say, therefore, because I'm the head of the home, my wife should serve me. Now, one person, the same source, gave the same idea, and two radically different things were done with it. So rather than dealing primarily with the labels, well, that's patriarchy or not patriarchy, or whatever it may be, actually look at what people are doing with ideas. Because it may be that some of the people that you might think they have the wrong label are actually doing things that are good, even though they might have a label you might not like. And it also may be that people who have the label that you think this is the good label are doing horrible things, even with good ideas. Because ultimately, in the battlefield of ideas, people do things with ideas that have effects in the real world. And ultimately, that's what we have to be most concerned about, is not what label we can ascribe to them, but whether they are engaging in actions that are sinful or actions that glorify God. And that's finally the test in our own lives as well. Not do we have all the right labels, do we check all the right boxes, but are we engaging in conduct that glorifies God or not? What are we doing with the ideas that we have? And if we're going to be valiant for truth, we need to be valiant for a truth that leads to the glory of God in our practical everyday lives. So conclusion, we need to be valiant for truth. We need to get the facts right. We need to research before we respond. We need to have the same standard for those we like and those we don't like. And we need to avoid some of the snares along the path by taking intentional care to see that we're seeking out truth. We need to get the spirit right. We need to be patient, charitable, and humble. And we need to get the targets right, not putting all our enemies in one basket, fighting ideas rather than slogans, and responding to what people do with ideas rather than where we may think that they got them. Any questions or comments? We have about 5 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes for conversation before we have to wrap up. Anyone? Going once, going twice. All right, well, let's go before the Lord in prayer and we will be done. Father, I come before you. I thank you for this time. I pray, Father, you would help us to be people who live for the truth, people who seek to be people of truth in the real world. Help us to be patient, humble, and charitable. Help us, Father, Lord, to be valiant for truth. Help us to live as Christians at all times and in all places and in all seasons of life. I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember, a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading for yourself.